And this is VOA 1, the hits. Forget.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Dan Friedel as well as John Russell, who presents this week's science report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Faith Perlow.
About 40 children have already started private classes in Berlin, just weeks after fleeing the war. Two teachers, who also fled to Germany, welcomed the children into their new classroom. Millions of Ukrainian refugees have crossed into neighboring countries, like Poland, as the war in Ukraine continues. Many have made their way to other European countries like Germany. The refugees are trying to rebuild their lives. Some have already started the necessary routines, like going to school. Maria Karashenko is a mother of two children and a Ukrainian refugee in Germany. She just sent her 7-year-old son, Miroslav, to his first day of school with about 40 other children. With tears in her eyes, 30-year-old Karashenko told a reporter, "It gets me emotional when I see all the help and solidarity here. Every day, I hope that we can go back to Ukraine. But it is too dangerous for now. So in the meantime, it is wonderful that my son can go to school in Germany," she added. The lessons will help prepare the children to enter the normal school system in Berlin. Berzhak Sevelgin and Faina Karlitsky organized the volunteer initiative for the refugees. In 2 weeks, the two raised money, organized the cost-free classrooms, and advertised the program on a messaging service. The children were nervous as they entered the building with their school books and pencils. But they can look forward to 3 hours of lessons a day. They will follow their curriculum from Ukraine and also take German language classes. The children are able to take part in after-school activities like painting and other arts and crafts. Two Ukrainians, Natalia Khalil and Tatiana Kubskaya, will teach the students. Natalia, from Western Ukraine, is age 33. She is teaching the third and fourth graders. Tatiana is age 56. She is teaching second graders like she did back home. She will also teach first graders. Kubskaya fled Ukraine with her daughter and a 7-year-old grandson. He is in her classroom. The kids are grateful to have some kind of routine again and meet other children from Ukraine. "They and their mothers have all been very stressed lately," said Kubskaya. The teachers will be paid in donations, about $550 a month, until they are officially permitted to work. Berzhak Sevilgin is a teacher in Berlin, and her friend Karlitsky is an administrative advisor. Together, they wanted to help get at least a few of the refugee children back to school quickly. They spent all of their free time organizing the classes. They raised money and organized classes with help from a Berlin children's support program called ARC. "We both have always had an eye for social issues and wanted to help here as well," Sevilgin said. The program received an offer for rooms at no cost in a Berlin immigrant neighborhood. The Ukrainian refugee mothers in Berlin connected with the program on a messaging service called Telegram. Since men ages 18 to 60 in Ukraine are not permitted to leave, the majority of Ukrainian refugees are women, mothers, and their children. 3 million Ukrainians fled abroad, and another 6 million are without homes inside of Ukraine's borders. Every day, about 10,000 refugees arrive to Berlin in trains. Germany has registered almost 250,000 Ukrainian refugees already. But the real number of refugees is unknown because thousands more have arrived by car. They are usually not registered if they come by car. Ukrainians do not need a visa to enter the country. Many of the refugees are staying in shelters or with relatives who immigrated in earlier years. Some Ukrainians are even staying at an old airport. The government is organizing a task force to help refugee children to attend schools in 16 German states. I'm Faith Perlow.
It is estimated that the U.S. has almost 1.7 million asylum cases waiting to be heard in immigration courts, and that is only for people who tried to enter along the border with Mexico. The administration of President Joe Biden has set rules that permit asylum officers, instead of judges, to decide asylum claims. That could help reduce the number of cases waiting for a hearing. However, with such a large number of refugees, it is unclear how soon people will see results. The new rules could go into effect in just over 60 days. The goal is for asylum seekers to find out their status in months instead of years. The changes affect both officers who are part of the Department of Homeland Security and judges whose courts are supervised by the Department of Justice. Alejandro Mayorkas leads the Department of Homeland Security. He said, "The current system has long needed repair." Merrick Garland is the U.S. Attorney General. He said, "The new rules will help ensure that asylum claims are processed fairly, expeditiously, and consistent with due process." Under the new rules, asylum officers will decide cases in 90 days. Those who are rejected will be seen by judges who will then decide their cases in 90 more days. The judges will be able to decide cases faster than in the past because they can get more information from the officers. Immigration experts are split on the new plan. Some believe the rules will prevent refugees from waiting so long for the safety of the U.S. But others say the process may move too quickly for refugees to find lawyers who can help their asylum request. Eleanor Acer is a director for refugee protection at Human Rights First. In a statement, she expressed concern about the increased speed, saying it could lead to mistakes and then more time in the courts to correct the mistakes. Others who worry that the U.S. is becoming too open to refugees said officers will not be as able as judges to reject false asylum claims. But government officials disagreed with that position. Another concern is that the U.S. is not planning to employ more asylum officers, even as they work to deal with the huge number of cases. Last year, the U.S. government estimated it needed 800 more asylum officers, but the new plan will not start by including new workers. In addition, the new rules may not be put in place as soon as Homeland Security and the Department of Justice would like. The announcement of the rules was released last August and received more than 5,300 comments from the public. Other changes to the immigration system during both the leadership of Presidents Donald Trump and Biden have faced legal action. I'm Dan Friedel.
As the United States pushes to use more low-carbon energy, there has been a recent improvement in relations between the hydropower industry and some environmental groups. The recent compromises are found in President Joe Biden's infrastructure law, which puts $2.5 billion toward projects including dam removals, as well as improvements to existing structures for hydropower and energy storage. Ted Ilston of American Rivers, a group that has pushed for dam removals on environmental grounds, recently told the Associated Press that the group recognizes that hydropower is probably going to play some role in the transition. It's certainly better than coal. Hydropower uses flowing water to move turbines connected to generators. It is the oldest and second largest sort of renewable energy in the U.S. after wind power. In 2020, it accounted for roughly 7% of the electricity generated in the country. The industry has not received as much federal money as wind and solar, but sees room for growth. Of the 90,000 dams in the country, about 2,500 produce power. Non-powered dams could produce enough power for 9 to 12 million homes, said an estimate by the Electric Power Supply Association based on federal data from 2012. In southwestern Pennsylvania, Rye Development, a Boston-based hydropower company, is adding turbines to 8 dams to generate electricity. The company says the improved structures will limit damage to the river's water quality and fish. Rye is among the companies that sees an opportunity to expand hydropower production at existing dams while working to minimize environmental harms. Part of the difficulty is that most dams in the U.S. were built more than 50 years ago. The risk of dam collapses has led to increased dam removals or demolitions in recent years, with more than 40% of the country's dam removals in the past century happening in the last 10 years. Last month, federal officials moved a step closer to approving what would be the largest dam demolition in U.S. history. Removal of the 4 hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River near the Oregon-California border would help save the river's salmon and other fish species that cannot reach breeding areas because of the structures. Despite some recent improvements in relations between the hydropower industry and environmental groups, there are still disagreements. On Maine's Kennebec River, environmental groups and state environmental agencies are pushing for the removal of 4 hydropower dams that block endangered Atlantic salmon from reaching key areas. The dams make about 5% of the state's renewable energy. Shannon Ames of the Low Impact Hydropower Institute said, "It's very easy for individual river systems to get lost in the message of climate change and the need for renewable energy. With drought affecting hydropower production in America's West, the industry has a more direct path to growth in eastern states. In Pennsylvania, Rye met with the Low Impact Hydropower Institute early in its process and is among a small number of companies seeking certification from the group. To get certified, companies must show their structures meet protections for endangered species. The group says its environmental requirements are often stricter than state or federal rules." I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 33rd president, Harry Truman. Truman was sometimes called an accidental president. He only became president because he was vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945. In the election of 1948, Truman ran for a full term. As we told you last week, many experts predicted he would lose. But voters chose him over the Republican Party candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York. Americans also elected a Congress with a majority from Truman's Democratic Party. The president might have expected a Congress led by his own party to support his policies, but that did not always happen. Time after time, Democrats from southern states joined in voting with conservative Republicans. Together, these lawmakers defeated some of Truman's most important proposals. One of the defeated bills was a proposal for health care insurance for every American. One of the major issues during Truman's second term was fear of communism. After World War II, Americans watched as one Eastern European nation after another became an ally of the Soviet Union. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin wanted to see communism spread around the world. And Americans watched as China became communist in 1949, as forces led by Mao Zedong defeated the Chinese nationalists after a civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. During this tense period, there were charges that communists held important jobs in the United States government. These fears, real or imagined, became known as the Red Scare.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
A Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, led the search for communists in America. In speeches and congressional hearings, he accused hundreds of people of being communists or communist supporters. His targets included the State Department, the Army, and the entertainment industry. Senator McCarthy often had little evidence to support his accusations. Many of his charges would not have been accepted in a court of law. But the rules governing congressional hearings were different, so he was able to make his accusations freely. Many people lost their jobs after they were denounced as communists. Some had to use false names to get work. A few went to jail briefly for refusing to cooperate with McCarthy. The senator continued his anti-communist investigations for several years. By the early 1950s, however, more people began to question his methods. Critics said he violated democratic traditions. In 1954, the Senate finally voted to condemn his actions. McCarthy died 3 years later. There were problems caused by the fear of communists at home. But President Truman also had to deal with the threat of communism in other countries. He agreed to send American aid to Greece and Turkey. He also supported continuing the Marshall Plan. That was the huge economic aid program that helped rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Many historians say the Marshall Plan prevented Western Europe from becoming communist. The defense of Western Europe against Soviet communism led Truman to support the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO began in 1949 with the United States, Britain, Canada, France, and eight other nations. The treaty that created NATO stated that a military attack on any member would be considered an attack on all of them. Truman named General Dwight Eisenhower to command the new organization. General Eisenhower had been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II. In his swearing-in speech in 1949, Truman urged the United States to lend money to other countries to aid their development. He also wanted to share American science and technology. In 1951, the president asked Congress to establish a new foreign aid program. The aid would go to countries threatened by communist forces in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and Latin America. Truman believed the United States would be stronger if its allies were stronger. President Truman believed that many of the world's problems could be settled by means other than military force. But he supported and used military power throughout his presidency. On June 25, 1950, forces from North Korea invaded South Korea. 2 days later, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution urging UN members to help South Korea resist the invasion. At first, President Truman agreed to send American planes and ships. Later, he agreed to send American ground forces. The president knew his decision could start World War III if the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of communist North Korea. Yet he felt the United States had to act. Later, he said it was the most difficult decision he made as president. Truman named Army General Douglas MacArthur to command all United Nations forces in South Korea. Most of the fighting in the Korean War took place along the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. This line formed the border between North and South Korea. Many victories on the battlefield were only temporary. One side would capture a hill, then the other side would recapture it. In September of 1950, MacArthur led the UN land and sea attack at Incheon, pushing the North Koreans back across the border. There was hope that the war could end by Christmas, December 25th. In late November, however, troops from China joined the North Koreans. Thousands of Chinese soldiers helped push the UN troops south. General MacArthur wanted to attack Chinese bases in Manchuria. President Truman said no. He did not want the fighting to spread beyond the Korean Peninsula. Again, he feared that such a decision could start another world war. MacArthur strongly believed he could end the war quickly by extending it to the Chinese mainland. He publicly denounced Truman's policy, saying, "There is no substitute for victory." Truman felt that the general left him no choice. In April of 1951, he dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In the United States, military leaders are expected to obey their commander-in-chief, the president. While some Americans approved of the general's dismissal, many others supported MacArthur. Millions greeted him when he returned to the United States. There were huge parades in his honor in San Francisco and New York. In fact, few leaders in the 20th century could boast the support MacArthur had. Almost 7 million people attended the ticker tape parade given to him by New York City. And that almost doubled the size of the one given to another returning World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower. MacArthur gave his farewell speech to a joint session of Congress on April 19, 1951.
"I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye."
On the Korean Peninsula, the war continued. Ceasefire talks began in July of 1951, but the conflict would last for another 2 years until a truce was declared. The Korean War Armistice Agreement was signed on July 27, 1953.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.